Chapter 5 of The Coming of the Law by Charles Alden Seltzer. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Girl of Dry Bottom. Hollis was not frightened, though he was in a position that might have aroused fear or apprehension in any man's mind. He was alone. The man had him covered with a rifle, and assuredly this was one of Dunleavy's hirelings. Hollis glanced swiftly around. Certain signs, some shrubbery that he saw through the canyon, a bald butte or two rising in the distance, told him that he was near the river, and Norton had told him to keep away from the river trail. In his eagerness to explore the country, he had forgotten all about Norton's warning. The prospect was not a hopeful one, yet Hollis could not have admitted to feeling any alarm. He realized that had the man intended any immediate harm, he would have shot him down long before this, while he had sat motionless in the saddle, inspecting the place. Concerning the man's intentions, he could only speculate, but assuredly they were not peaceful. For a little time, the man remained motionless, and Hollis sat quiet, looking at him. The weapon had not moved. Its muzzle still menaced him, and he watched it closely, wondering whether the man would give him any warning when about to pull the trigger. Many minutes dragged, and the man did not move. A slow anger began to steal over Hollis. The man's inaction grated on his nerves. "Well," he challenged sharply, "what do you want?" There was no answer. Hollis could only see the man's head and shoulders projecting above the boulder, and the rifle, steady and level, menacing him. With an exclamation of rage and disdain, he seized the bridle rein and pulled sharply on it, swinging the pony's head around. The rifle crashed venomously. Hollis felt the right sleeve of his shirt flutter, and he pulled the pony abruptly up. "Just to show you," came the man's voice mockingly, "if you move again until I give you the word, you won't know where you've been hit." Hollis was satisfied. The man undoubtedly meant business. He settled back into the saddle and looked down at his shirt sleeve. The bullet had passed very close to the arm. If that man had meant the bullet for that particular spot, he was a deadly marksman. In the face of such marvelous shooting, Hollis did not care to experiment further, but his anger had not yet abated. "No doubt you are enjoying yourself," he said with bitter sarcasm, "but the pleasure is all yours. I am not enjoying myself a bit, I assure you, and I don't like the idea of being a target for you to shoot at." A laugh came back to Hollis, a strange, unnatural, sardonic cackle that, in spite of his self-control, caused his flesh to creep. And then the man's voice, "No, you don't like it. I knew that all along. But you're going to stay here for 7 weeks while I shoot holes in you." He laughed again, his voice high and shrill, its cackling cadences filling the place. "7 weeks in Devil's Hollow," came the voice again. "7 weeks, 7 weeks." Hollis felt his heart thumping heavily against his ribs, while a sinking sensation in the pit of his stomach told him that his courage was touched. He realized now why the man had not shot him down immediately. He was a maniac. For a few terrible seconds, Hollis sat in the saddle while the world reeled around him, while the rocks and cliffs danced fantastically. Courage he had, to be sure. He had already become resigned to death before the man's rifle, but he had imagined the man to be in full possession of his senses, imagined his death to have been planned out of the deliberate coolness of reason. Such a death would have been bad enough, but to meet death at the hands of a man mentally unbalanced, somehow it seemed different, seemed horribly unreal, like a terrible nightmare. It was some seconds before he regained control of himself, and then he steadied himself in the saddle, assuring himself, in a burst of bitter, ironic humor, that death at the hands of a crazy man could be no worse than death at the hands of a rational one. He looked up again, a defiant smile on his lips, to see that both man and rifle had disappeared. In a flash he saw his chance and took advantage of it. In an instant he was off his pony. In another he was behind a convenient rock, breathing easier, his senses alert. For some little time he remained in the shelter of the rock, awaiting the other man's movements. He did not doubt that, acting upon some freakish impulse, the man had left his boulder and was even now stalking him from some other direction. He peered carefully about him. He had no thought of shooting the man. That would be murder, for the man was not mentally responsible for his actions. His efforts must be centered slowly upon some plan for saving his own life. To do this, he realized that he must be careful. In view of the man's unerring marksmanship, it would be certain death for him to expose himself for an instant. But he must take some chances. Convinced of this, he peered around the edge of his rock, taking a flashing glance around him. The man was nowhere to be seen. Hollis waited some little time, and then, taking another glance and not seeing the man, slowly rose to his feet and crouched. Then, filled with a sudden, reckless impulse, he sprang for another rock a dozen feet distant, expecting each instant to hear the crash of the man's rifle. But he succeeded in gaining the shelter of the other rock intact. Evidently the man was looking for him in some other direction. Emboldened with his success, he grimly determined on advancing to another rock some 20 or 30 feet farther on. As in the first instance, he succeeded in gaining it in safety. His maneuvering had been circuitous, bringing him into a position from which he could see partly behind the rock where the man had been concealed. And now, having gained the second rock in safety, Hollis decided to take no more chances. Sooner or later, he was convinced, the man was sure to see him as he jumped. He did not like the picture that his imagination conjured up. Therefore, his actions were now marked with more caution. It took him a long time to gain a position where he could peer over the upper edge of the rock behind which he was concealed. But he gained it finally, and then dropped back with an exclamation of surprise. He had caught a glimpse of the man. He was lying face upward behind the boulder, his arms outstretched, his rifle lying in the dust near him. Hollis was tempted to make a run for his pony, mount, and race out of the hollow. But a second thought restrained him. He had considered the man's action merely a ruse. But why should he attempt it, after he had once had an opportunity to make use of his rifle? Still, for an instant, Hollis hesitated, for he knew there was no rule by which a maniac's actions might be judged. Then, with a grim laugh, he sprang over the few feet that separated him from the man, approaching him carefully, still slightly doubtful. But the man was not shamming. Hollis could see that when he had approached close enough to see his face. It bore a curious pallor. His eyes were wide open and staring, and some foam flecked his lips. Evidently, he had been overcome by a paroxysm of his malady at about the moment Hollis had discovered it. Hollis stepped back and heaved a sigh of relief. Then he stepped over to where the man's rifle lay, taking it up and removing the cartridges. Returning to the man, he removed the cartridges from his belt and drew a six-shooter from his holster, determined that when the man recovered from his stupor, there would be no danger of a reoccurrence of the previous incident. Then he leaned against the boulder to await the man's recovery. 10 minutes later, while he still watched the man, he heard a clatter of hoofs. Determined not to be taken by surprise again, he drew his own six-shooter and peered cautiously around the edge of the boulder. What he saw caused him to jam the weapon back into its holster very hurriedly. Then he stepped out of his concealment with a red, embarrassed face to greet a young woman whose expression of doubt and fear was instantly replaced by one of pleasure and recognition as she caught sight of him. It was the girl of Dry Bottom. "Oh," she said, "it is you. I was afraid." And then she saw the man and was off her pony in a flash and at his head, supporting it and pouring something down his throat from a bottle. She rose presently. Embarrassment crimsoned her face. Hollis saw her lips quiver, when she turned and spoke to him. "He will be all right now," she said, facing Hollis, her eyes drooping as though ashamed to meet his. "He has had another attack of his trouble." She looked suddenly up at Hollis, bravely trying to repress her emotion, but with little success. "You heard what he, Big Bill Dunlavey, said about my brother?" she questioned, her eyes full and moist. Hollis nodded, and she continued rapidly, her voice quavering. "Well, he told the truth." Her voice trailed away into a pitiful wail, and she stepped over and leaned against the boulder, sobbing quietly into her hands. "That's why it hurts so," she added. Hollis yielded to a sudden wave of sympathy. He stood close to her, aware of his inability to cope with this strange situation. She looked so small, so out of place. He felt that whatever he did or said would not help matters. What he did say, however, assisted in restoring her composure. "I'm glad I slugged him," he said heatedly. She turned suddenly to him, her eyes flashing spiritedly through the moisture in them. "Oh, it was great," she declared, her hands clenching at the recollection. "I could have shaken hands with you, with the hand that struck him." Hollis smiled whimsically. "I've still got the hand," he said significantly, extending it toward her, "and if you have not reconsidered..." He laughed as she took it and pressed it firmly. "I rather think that we both got a shake coming on that," he added. "I didn't understand then about your brother, or I would have added a few extra pounds to that punch." Her face clouded as he mentioned her brother. "Poor Ed," she said in a low voice. She went over to the man, leaning over him and smoothing back the hair from his forehead. Hollis, looking glumly on, clenching his teeth in impotent sympathy. "These attacks do not come often," she volunteered, as she again approached Hollis. "But they do come," she added, her voice catching. Hollis did not reply, feeling that he had no right to be inquisitive. But she continued, slightly more at ease and plainly pleased to have someone in whom she might confide. "Ed was injured a year ago through a fall," she informed Hollis. "He was breaking a wild horse, and a saddle girth broke, and he fell, striking on his head. The wound healed, but he has never been the same. At intervals, these attacks come on, and then he is irresponsible and dangerous." She shuddered. "You were watching him," she added, looking suddenly at him. "Did you find him as he is, or did he attack you?" "Frequently, when he has these attacks, he comes here to Devil's Hollow, explaining that he expects to find some of Dunleavy's men. He doesn't like Dunlavey," she added with a flush, "since Dunlavey..." She hesitated and then went on determinedly. "Well, since Dunlavey told him that he wanted to marry me. But Ed says that Dunlavey has a wife in Tucson, and, well, I wouldn't have married him anyway, the brute." "Exactly," agreed Hollis gravely, trying to repress a thrill of satisfaction. "Of course you couldn't marry him." He understood now the meaning of Dunleavy's words to her in Dry Bottom. "If you wasn't such a damn prude," he had said. He looked at the girl with a sudden grim smile. "He said something about running you and your brother out of the country," he said. "Of course you won't allow him to do that." The girl's slight figure stiffened. "I would like to see him try it," she declared defiantly. Hollis grinned. "That's the stuff," he sympathized. "I rather think that Dunlavey is something of a bluffer, that folks in this country have allowed him to have his own way too much." She shook her head doubtfully. "I don't know about that," she returned. Then she smiled. "You are the new owner of the Circle Bar, aren't you?" Hollis, startled, looking at her with a surprised smile. "Yes," he returned, "I am the new owner. But how did you know it? I haven't told anyone here except Neil Norton and Judge Graney. Have Norton and the judge been talking?" "They haven't talked to me," she assured him with a demure smile. "You see," she added, "you are a stranger in Dry Bottom, and after you left the Fashion, you went right down to the courthouse. I knew that Judge Graney had been your father's friend, and then I saw Neil Norton coming into town with a buckboard." She laughed. "You see, It wasn't very hard to add two and two." "Why, no," Hollis agreed, "it wasn't. But how did you happen to see me go down to the courthouse?" "Why, I watched you," she returned, and then suddenly aware of her mistake in admitting that she had felt an interest in him at their first meeting, she lowered her gaze in confusion and stood kicking with her booted toe into a hummock, her face suddenly very red. The situation might have been embarrassing for her had not her brother created a diversion by suddenly sighing and struggling to sit up. The girl was at his side in an instant, assisting him. The young man's bewilderment was pitiful. He sat silent for a full minute, gazing first at his sister and then at Hollis and finally at his surroundings. Then, when a rational gleam had come into his eyes, he bowed his head, a blush of shame sweeping over his face and neck. "I expect I've been at it again," he muttered without looking up. The girl leaned over him, reassuring him, patting his face lovingly, and letting him know by all a woman's arts of the sympathy and love she bore for him. Hollis watched her with a grim, satisfied smile. If he had had a sister, he would have hoped that she would be like her. He stepped forward and seized the young man by the arm, helping him to his feet. "You are right now," he assured him. "There has been no harm done." Standing, the young man favored Hollis with a careful inspection. He flushed again. "You're the man that rode through the draw," he said. "I saw you and thought you were one of Dunleavy's men. I shot at you once and was going to shoot again, but something cracked in my head. I hope I didn't hit you." Embarrassment again seized him. His eyes drooped. "Of course you are not one of Dunleavy's men," he added, "or you wouldn't be here talking to Sis. No friend of Dunleavy's could do that." He looked at the girl with a tender smile. "I don't know what I'd do if it wasn't for her," he added, speaking to Hollis, "but I expect it's a good thing that I'm not crazy all the time." He looked searchingly at Hollis. "I've never seen you before," he said. "Who are you?"
"I'm Kent Hollis."
The young man's eyes lighted. "Not Jim Hollis's son?" he asked. Hollis nodded. The young man's face revealed genuine pleasure. "You're going to stay in this here country?" he asked.
"I'm going to run the Circle Bar," returned Hollis slowly.
"Bully," declared the young man. "There's some folks around here said you wouldn't have nerve enough to stay." He made a wry face. "But I reckon you've got nerve, or you'd have hit the breeze when I started to stampede." He suddenly held out his hand. "I like you," he said impulsively. "You and me are going to be friends. Shake." Hollis saw a smile of pleasure light up the girl's face, which she tried to conceal by brushing the young man's clothing with a gloved hand, meanwhile keeping him between her and Hollis. Hollis stood near the boulder, watching them as they prepared to depart, the girl telling her brother that he was find his pony on the plains beyond the canyon.
"I'm glad I didn't hit you," the young man told Hollis as he started away with the girl. "If you are not scared off, you might take a run down to the shack sometime. It's just down the creek a ways."
Hollis hesitated, and then, catching the girl's glance, he smiled. "I can't promise when," he said, looking at the girl, "but you may be sure that I will look you up the first chance I get." He stood beside the boulder until he saw them disappear around the wall of the canyon. Then, with a satisfied grin, he walked to his pony, mounted, and was off through the draw toward the Circle Bar ranch house. End of chapter 5. Chapter 6 of The Coming of the Law by Charles Alden Seltzer. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Hollis renews an acquaintance. Rumor, that mysterious disseminator of news, whose tongues are legion, whispered that the Dry Bottom Kicker was to come to life. Wherefore curiosity led many of Dry Bottom's citizens past the door of the Kicker office to steal covert glances at the young man whose figure was bent over the desk inside. Many passed in silence after looking at the young man.
He did not see them. Others commented gravely or humorously, according to their whim. The young man did not hear them. Seated at the desk, he gave his attention to the tasks before him. He was not concerned with rumor. The curiosity of Dry Bottom citizens did not affect him. Seriously, methodically, steadily, he worked at his desk, while rumor wagged her tongues and curiosity lounged past the window. It was Hollis's first visit to the Kicker office. He had come to work, and there was much that he could do. He found the Kicker installed in a one-story frame building, verging upon dilapidation, unpainted, dingy. The appearance of its exterior had given Hollis a queer sensation in the pit of his stomach. He was cheered a little by the businesslike appearance of the interior. It was not what he had been used to, but he felt that it would answer very well in this locality, and, well, he planned to make improvements. About 20 by 40, he estimated the size of the interior. Originally, there had been only one room. This had been divided into three sections by partitions. An old flat-topped desk sat near the front window, a swivel chair before it. Along the wall above the desk were several rows of shelving, with pasteboard boxes and paper piled neatly up. Calendars, posters, and other specimens of the printer's art covered the walls. In the next room was another desk, piles of advertising electrotypes. Empty forms and papers filled the corners. The composing room was in the rear. Everything was in order here, type cases, stands, forms. There were a proof press, some galley racks, a printing press with a forlorn-looking gasoline engine near it. A small cast-iron stove stood in a corner with its door yawning open, its front bespattered with tobacco juice. A dilapidated, imposing stone ranged along the rear wall near a door that opened into the sunlight. A man stood before one of the type cases, distributing type. He did not look up at Hollis's entrance. "Hello," greeted Hollis. The man hesitated in his work and looked up. "Hello," he returned, perfunctorily. "I suppose your name is Potter?" Hollis inquired cordially. Judge Granny had told him that if he succeeded in finding the compositor, he would have him at the Kicker office this morning. Potter had gone to work without further orders. "Yes," said the man. He came forward. "I am the new owner of the Kicker," Hollis informed him with a smile. "Jim Hollis's boy?" inquired Potter, straightening. At Hollis's nod, he stepped quickly forward and grasped the hand the latter offered him, squeezing it tightly. "Of course you are Jim Hollis's boy," he said, finishing his inspection. "You are the living image of him." He swept his hand around toward the type case. "I am working, you see. Judge Granny wrote me last week that you wanted me, and I came as soon as I could. Is it true that the Kicker is going to be a permanent institution?" "The Kicker is here to stay," Hollis informed him. Potter's face lighted with pleasure. "That's bully," he said. "That's bully." He was of medium height, slender, lean-faced, with a magnificent head and a wealth of brown hair thickly streaked with silver. His thin lips were strong. His chin, though a trifle weak, was well-formed. His eyes slightly bleared, but revealing, in spite of this defect, unmistakable intelligence. In the first flashing glance which Hollis had taken of him, he had been aware that here was a person of more than ordinary mental ability and refinement. It was with a pang of pity that he remembered Judge Graney's words to the effect that he was a good workman when sober. Hollis felt genuinely sorry for him. "I have had a talk with Judge Graney," volunteered Potter. "He tells me that you are a newspaper man. Between us, we ought to be able to get out a very respectable paper." "We will," calmly announced Hollis, "and we'll get the first issue out Saturday. Come in here and we'll talk about it." He led the way to the front room and seated himself at the desk, motioning Potter to another chair. Within the next hour, he knew all about the Kicker. It was a six-column sheet of four pages. The first page was devoted to local news. The second carried some local advertisements, exchange clippings, and two or three columns of syndicate plate matter. On the third page, two columns were devoted to editorials, one to advertisements, and three to local news in large type. The fourth and last page was filled with more plate matter and a litter of foreign advertising, patent medicines, soaps, hair dye. At the first glance, it appeared that the paper must be a paying proposition, for there were a goodly portion of advertisements. Yet Hollis had his suspicions about the advertisements. When he had spoken to Potter about them, he discovered that quite a number of them were what is known to the craft as dead ads, which meant advertisements upon which payment had ceased, and which were carried either for the purpose of filling up the paper, or because it was found cheaper to run them than to set type for the space which would be left by their absence. "We won't carry any dead ads," announced Hollis. "Several of these are big merchants," said Potter, pointing them out with inky forefinger. "Though the contracts have run out, the appearance of their ad lends the kicker a certain moral support. The little fellows don't know that they are not paid for, and it draws their business." "We don't care for that kind of business," smiled Hollis. "We're going to run a real newspaper. We're going to get paid ads."
"I hope so," hesitatingly replied Potter.
"Of course you do," laughed Hollis. "But whether we get paid ads or not, this newspaper is coming out regularly and on time. Furthermore, we're going to cut down on this plate stuff. We don't want a paper filled with stale articles on snakes, antedated ocean disasters, Egyptian monoliths, and the latest style in opera hats. We'll fill the paper with local news. We'll ginger things up a little.
You are pretty well acquainted here. I'll leave the local items to you. What town near here compares with Dry Bottom in size?"
"There's Lazette," returned Potter, "over in Colfax County."
"How far from here?"
80 miles.
"Got a newspaper?"
"Yes, the Eagle."
"Bully, step on the Eagle's toes. Make the Eagle scream. Get into an argument with it about something, anything. Tell Lazette that as a town, it's 40 miles behind Dry Bottom. That will stir up public spirit and boom our subscription list. You see, Potter, civic pride is a big asset to a newspaper. We'll start a row right off the reel. Furthermore, we're going to have some telegraph news. I'll make arrangements for that today." Hollis's enthusiasm was infectious. A flash of spirit lighted up Potter's eyes as he rose from his chair. "I'm going to set up the head for the first page," he said. "Probably you'll want a slogan. That sort of thing is the style out here."
"We'll have one," returned Hollis briskly. "Set this in triple leads. We herald the coming of the law. The kicker is here to stay."
"Good," declared Potter. He went into the composing room, and Hollis saw his fine old head bent over a type case. Hollis turned to his desk. He sat there long, his tall, lithe body slack, grim, serious lines in his lean face. He had thought of his conversation with Judge Graney concerning ambition, his ambition, the picture upon which his mind had dwelt many times. A little frame printing office in the West was not one of its features. He sighed with resignation and began methodically to look over the papers in the desk, finding many things to interest him. He discovered that in spite of his father's one great fault, he had been a methodical man. He smiled regretfully, wishing that he might have been able to have seen more of him. Among the papers, he hoped to find a personal note, a word from his father. He found nothing of that character. After a time, he took up a pen and began to write. Long ago he had decided that in the first issue of the paper he would attack the Cattlemen's Association. Judge Graney had ridden out to the Circle Bar on the previous Saturday afternoon, remaining over Sunday and accompanying Hollis on the return trip
Monday morning. While at the ranch, the judge had spent much of his time in communicating to Hollis his views of the situation in Union County and acquainting him with the elder Hollis's intentions regarding the newspaper. Hollis had made some inquiries of his own account, with the result that when he reached the Kicker office this morning, he felt that he had acquired a good and sufficient knowledge of the situation. Looking over the old copy of the Kicker, he studied some of the advertisements. Evidently some Dry Bottom merchants had been brave enough to antagonize Dunleavy by advertising in the Kicker. With his copy of the Kicker in hand, Hollis rose from his desk, told Potter he was going out, and proceeded to visit some of the merchants whose advertisements appeared in the paper, hoping their bravery still abided with them. He made a good solicitor. Some of the merchants flatly refused, saying they did not care to risk Dunleavy's anger. Others demurred, confidentially announcing that they had never considered the paper seriously, and there was really no good in advertising in Dry Bottom anyway. The town wasn't big enough. Half a dozen listened quietly while he told them that the Kicker was in Dry Bottom to stay, and then smiled and told him to run their advertisements. They rather admired his nerve and were not afraid of Dunleavy. At noon, Hollis stepped into a restaurant called the Alhambra. While he ate, he was critically inspected. The Alhambra swarmed with customers, and the proprietor quietly informed him that he was a drawing card and hoped he'd grub there regularly. In return for his promise to do so, Hollis secured his advertisement. Leaving the Alhambra, he returned to the Kicker office, seating himself again at his desk. The sun came slantwise through the window full upon him. The heat was oppressive. The flint-like alkali dust sifted through the crevices in the building and settled over everything in the room. Myriad flies droned in the white sunlight before the open door. He heard nothing, felt nothing, saw nothing, for his thoughts were miles away. In an upper story of a big office building in the east, from whose windows he even now looked down upon a bustling city. Life would be so different here. He heard a sound behind him and turned. Dunleavy was standing just inside the door, his great arms folded over his chest. He had been watching Hollis, his eyes narrowed with a cynically humorous expression. Hollis knew that by this time Dunleavy must have discovered his identity. He swung slowly around in his chair, his face wearing an expression of whimsical amusement as he greeted his victim of a few days previous. "Welcome to the Kicker office," he said quietly. Dunleavy did not move. Evidently, he had expected another sort of greeting and was slightly puzzled over Hollis's manner. He remained motionless, and Hollis had an opportunity to study him carefully and thoroughly. His conclusions were brief and comprehensive. They were expressed tersely to himself as he waited for Dunleavy to speak. A trickster and a cheat, dangerous. Dunleavy's eyes flashed metallically for an instant, but immediately the humorous cynicism came into them again. "I don't think you mean all of that," he said evenly. Hollis laughed. "I'm not in the habit of saying things that I do not mean," he said quietly. "I am here to do business, and I am ready to talk to anybody who wants to do business with me." Dunleavy's hands fell to his sides and were shoved into his capacious trousers pockets. "Right," he said tersely. "That's what I'm here for, to talk business." He pulled a chair over close to Hollis and seated himself in it, moving deliberately, a certain grim reserve in his manner. Hollis watched him, marveling at his self-control. He reflected that it required willpower of a rare sort to repress or conceal the rage which he surely must feel over his humiliation of 2 weeks before. That Dunleavy was able to so mask his feelings convinced Hollis that he had to deal with a man of extraordinary character. "I recollect meeting you the other day," said Dunleavy, after he had become seated. He smiled with his lips, his eyes glittering again. "I'll say that we got acquainted then. There ain't no need for us to shake hands now." He showed his teeth in a mirthless grin. "I didn't know you then, but I know you now. You're Jim Hollis's boy." Hollis nodded. Dunleavy continued evenly, "Your father and me wasn't what you might call bosom friends. I reckon Judge Graney has told you that. If he ain't, you've heard it from someone else. It don't make any difference, so there won't be any misunderstanding. I'll tell you that I ain't figuring on you and me hitching up to the mutual friendship wagon either. I might say that we wasn't introduced right." He grinned evilly. "But I ain't letting what happened interfere with the business that brought me here today. I've heard that you were intending to start the kicker again, that you're figuring on staying here and running the Circle Bar. What I'm here for is to buy you out. I'm offering you $15,000 for the Circle Bar and this damn newspaper." Dunleavy had lost a little of the composure which had characterized his actions since entering the office, and the last words of his speech had writhed venomously through his lips. Hollis's face betrayed absolutely no emotion. Though Dunleavy's visit to the Kicker office had surprised him, he was not surprised at his offer for the ranch and the newspaper, for according to Judge Graney, he had made some such offer to the elder Hollis. Coming now with an addition of $5,000, Dunleavy's offer seemed to advertise his reluctance to continue the war that he had waged. Hollis appreciated the situation. If Dunleavy were to buy him off now, there would come an end to the warfare that had already been an expensive one for the interest represented by Dunleavy. Likewise, the acceptance of the offer would give Hollis an opportunity to withdraw gracefully. Dunleavy had placed the issue squarely before him. The young man held his future in his hands, and he did not reply at once. He sat silent for a few moments, studying the coarse, brutal face of the man seated before him, noting that his underjaw had come forward slightly, and that the cold, hard glitter had come again in his eyes. However, Hollis's silence meant nothing beyond the fact that he was slowly going over the history of the fight between his father and the man who sat there representing the interests which had begun the war. He had no thought of surrendering. That would be dishonorable. He was merely revolving the situation in his mind, considering how best to word his refusal. He did not want to appear belligerent. He did not want to precipitate a war, but he did want Dunleavy to know that he proposed to have his rights. He wanted Dunleavy to know that he could not be frightened into surrendering them. He clasped one hand over his knee and leaned back in his chair, his gaze meeting Dunleavy's steadily. "Dunleavy," he said quietly, "what is the actual value of the Circle Bar Ranch?" Dunleavy smiled blandly. "You couldn't find any man around these parts to take it at any price," he returned. "Why?" questioned Hollis. Dunleavy grinned mysteriously. "I reckon you know why," he returned. "You're pretty much of a tenderfoot, but I reckon Judge Graney has put you wise to the situation. There ain't nobody wants to buy the Circle Bar except me." "Why?" persisted Hollis. "I reckon you know that too," laughed Dunleavy. "It ain't no secret. The Cattlemen's Association is running things in this here county, and it ain't wanting anyone to buy the Circle Bar except me. And nobody is fool enough to antagonize the association. That's the why, if you want to know real bad." "You are frank about it, at any rate," conceded Hollis, smiling slightly. "But that doesn't get us anywhere. What I'm trying to get at is this. What would the Circle Bar bring in cash if the Cattlemen's Association ceased to be a factor in the county?" Dunleavy grinned broadly. "For a tenderfoot, you're real amusing," he derided. "There ain't nobody out here crazy enough to think that the Cattlemen's Association will ever be put out of business." Hollis's lips curled a little, but his gaze was still steady. "That's evasion, Dunlavey," he said quietly. "You will remember that I asked you what the Circle Bar would bring if the association ceased to be a factor." Dunlavey favored Hollis with a perplexed grin. "I don't know what difference that makes," he returned. "We're dealing with what's before us now. We ain't considering what might be. But if you want to know my personal opinion, is that the Circle Bar might bring 30,000. "Thanks," said Hollis dryly. "That's getting somewhere. And now we'll be able to talk business. We've got 30,000 to start with. I am told that when the association began its war against my father, he was rather prosperous. Usually he rounded up about 2,000 head of cattle, but we'll call it 1,000. We'll say that they brought about $30 a head, which would make an income of $30,000 a year, gross. We'll deduct 50% for operating expenses, losses, and so on. That would leave about 15,000. You've been fighting the Circle Bar for several years. We'll call it 5. 5 times 15,000 is 75,000. That represents the sum which my father would have made from the Circle Bar if you had not fought him. Add to that the 30,000, which you admit would be a fair figure for the ranch if the association were eliminated as a factor, and we have a total of $105,000. He smiled and leaned a little farther back in his chair, narrowing his eyes at Dunlavey. "Now we have reached the point where we can get somewhere. I'll take $100,000 for the Circle Bar." The calm announcement had no effect upon Dunlavey except to cause him to grin derisively. "For a tenderfoot, you're pretty slick," he allowed, his teeth showing. "You've figured it out so that it sounds right reasonable. But you forgot one thing. The Cattlemen's Association ain't eliminated. It says that the Circle Bar is worth 15,000. You take that, or..." He smiled grimly, holding back the threat. "I think I know what you mean," said Hollis quietly, without changing color. "You mean that the Cattlemen's Association will continue its fight and eventually ruin the Circle Bar. Perhaps it will. No man can tell what lies in the future. But I can tell you this, you can't retard progress." "No," said Dunlavey, with an irritating drawl. Hollis smiled composedly. He spoke without bitterness. "Dunlavey," he said, "I'm going to tell you something which you perhaps know but will not admit. Your association has been successful in pulling the strings which make the politicians at Washington jump to do your bidding. I don't accuse you of buying them. But in any event, they have greased the ways over which your association has slipped to power, and now you think that the impetus you have gained will carry you along indefinitely. It won't. Everything in this world runs its natural course, and when it does, there comes an end. If you were endowed with the average foresight, you would be able to see that things cannot always go on the way they have. The law must come. It's inevitable. It's coming will be facilitated by such organizations as the Cattlemen's Association and by such men as you. Back in the East, the forces of good and bad are battling. The forces of good will be victorious. The government at Washington is familiar with the conditions that exist here and sooner or later will be compelled to act. When it does, the small cattle owners will receive protection." "We're holding tight till the law comes," sneered Dunlavey, "which won't be soon." "Perhaps not," admitted Hollis dryly. "Good things come slowly. Meanwhile, if you don't care to accept my figure for the Circle Bar, I shall follow your example and hold tight until the law comes." "Meaning that you won't sell, I suppose," sneered Dunlavey. "Meaning just that," returned Hollis quietly. "I'm going to fight you. I have offered the Circle Bar at a fair figure, and you have responded with threats. I wouldn't sell it to you now if you offered 150,000. The Circle Bar is not for sale." Dunlavey had not moved. He sat quiet, leaning a little forward, his hands resting on his knees. His eyes narrowed to glittering pinpoints as he watched Hollis. When the latter had concluded, he leaned back, laughing hoarsely.
"What are you going to do with this damn newspaper?" he demanded.
"The newspaper will be used as a weapon against you," returned Hollis. "It will kick loud and long against such organizations as the Cattlemen's Association, against such men as you. Ostensibly, the Kicker will be a dry bottom newspaper, but it will appear in every city in the East. The matter that appears in it will be reprinted in Chicago, in Washington, in New York, in fact, in every city in which I have a friend engaged in the newspaper business, and I have a number. I'm going to stir up sentiment against you. I'm going to be the law's advanced agent."
Dunleavy rose, his lips curling with contempt. "You make me sick," he sneered. He turned his back and walked to the door, returning and standing in front of Hollis, ominously cool and deliberate. "So that's the how of it," he said evenly. "You've come out here looking for a fight. Well, you'll get it, plenty of it. I owe you something."
"Wait, Dunleavy," Hollis interrupted, without excitement. "I want you to understand that there isn't anything personal in this. I'm going to fight you because you are a member of the Cattlemen's Association and not because you are my father's enemy. I am not afraid of you. I suspect you will try to make things decidedly interesting for me from now on, and I suppose I ought to be properly troubled. But I am not. I shall not be surprised at anything you do. I think that is all. Please close the door when you go out." He turned to the desk, ignoring Dunleavy. Sitting there, his senses alert, he heard the door slam. From beyond it came a curse. Silence again reigned in the office. Hollis was alone with the dust and the heat and some very original thoughts. End of chapter 6.
Chapter 7 of The Coming of the Law by Charles Alden Seltzer. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Kicker becomes an institution. It was mid-July and hot. The sun shone continually. The nights were uncomfortable, stifling. The dust was everywhere and grew deeper and lighter as the days passed. Water grew scarce. Cattle suffered, lowing throughout the night, during the day searching the bogs and water holes for drops of moisture. Men looked up at the clear, cloudless sky and prayed and cursed for rain. The rain did not come. It was one long, continuous nightmare of heat. The Kicker had appeared four times, on Saturdays, on time. Telegraphic communication with the outside world had been established. Potter had taken up his residence at the Circle Bar. War had been declared between the Kicker and the Lazette Eagle. Hollis had written an argumentative essay on the virtues of Dry Bottom as a town, dwelling upon its superiority over Lazette. The editor of the Eagle had replied with some bitterness, setting forth in detail why Dry Bottom did not compare with Lazette. As the editor of the Eagle mentioned population and civic spirit in his bill of particulars, the war promised to be of long duration. Questions of superiority between spirited persons are never settled, and Hollis had succeeded in arousing the spirit of Dry Bottom's citizens. They began to take some interest in the Kicker. Many subscribed, all read it. From the local columns of the paper, one might have discovered that many public and private improvements were contemplated. Among these, the following items were of the greatest interest. Steps are being taken by the government toward the erection of a fence around the courthouse grounds. Judge Granny is contemplating a lawn and flowers. When these improvements are completed, there will be no comparison between our courthouse and the dilapidated hovel which disgraces the county seat of Colfax. The Lazette Eagle, please notice. William Dunn, the proprietor of the Alhambra Eating House, announces that in the near future he will erect a new sign. Thereafter, the Alhambra
will be known as the Alhambra Restaurant. This is a step forward. We have been informed that there is no restaurant in Lazette. Good boy, Dunn. Chet Miller's general merchandise store is to be repainted throughout. Chet is public-spirited. Everybody of any importance in Dry Bottom received weekly mention of some sort in the Kicker. Chet Miller was heard to say that the Kicker was a hummer, and no one ascribed his praise of the paper to thanks for the appearance of his name therein, for all who would have criticized were silenced by the appearance of their own names. In the fourth issue of the paper appeared several new advertisements. Judicious personal mention and lively news locals had aroused public spirit to a point where it ignored thoughts of Dunleavy's displeasure. Upon the Saturday, which had marked the first issue of the Kicker under Hollis's ownership, he had employed a circulation manager. That afternoon, on the street near the Kicker office, he had almost collided with a red-haired youth of uncertain age who had bounded out through the door of a private dwelling. In order to keep from knocking the youth over, Hollis was forced to seize him by the arms and literally lift him off his feet. While in the air, the youth's face was close to Hollis's, and both grinned over the occurrence. When Hollis set the youth down, he stood for an instant, looking up into Hollis's face, and a grin of amusement overspread his own. "Shucks," he said slowly, "if it ain't the Tenderfoot editor." "That's just who it is," returned Hollis with a smile. The youth grinned as he looked critically at Hollis. "You getting out that there paper today, mister?" he questioned. "Right now," returned Hollis. "Bully!" exclaimed the youth. He surveyed Hollis with a frank admiration. "They said you wouldn't have the nerve to do it," he said. "But say, I reckon they ain't got you sized up right." Hollis smiled, remembering that though the paper had been printed, it was not yet distributed. He placed a hand on the youth's shoulder. "Have you got nerve enough to pass the Kicker around to the people of this town?" he questioned. "I reckon," grinned the youth. "I was coming down to ask you for the job when you bumped into me. I used to peddle them for your dad. My name's Jiggs Lanahan. Maybe you've heard of me." Hollis smiled. "The question of delivering the Kicker was one of the details that I overlooked," he said. "But fortunately, it is arranged now. Henceforth, Jiggs, you are the Kicker's official circulation manager. Likewise, if you care to add to your income, you can help Potter around the office." So it had been arranged, and Jiggs entered upon his duties with an energy that left little doubt in his employer's mind that he would prove a valuable addition to the force. In Hollis's salutatory to the people of Dry Bottom, he had announced in a quiet, unostentatious paragraph that while he had not come to Dry Bottom for a free fight, he would permit no one to tread on his toes. His reader's comprehension of the metaphor was complete, as was evidenced by the warm handclasps which he received from citizens who were not in sympathy with the Dunleavy regime. It surprised him to find out how many such there were in town. He was convinced that all this element needed was a leader, and he was grimly determined to step quietly into that position himself. The second issue of the Kicker was marked by a more aggressive spirit, a spirit engendered by the sympathetic reception of the first issue. In it, he stated concisely his views of the situation in Union County, telling his readers that the best interest of the community demanded that Dunleavy's evil influence be wiped out. This article was headed "Dry Bottom's Future," and won him many friends. The third issue contained stronger language, and the fourth was energetically aggressive. As he decided before the first appearance of the paper, he took a certain number of copies of each issue, folded them neatly, stamped and addressed them, and mailed them to a number of newspapers throughout the country whose editors he knew. He also directed copies to a number of his friends in the East, to the president of his college, and last, to the Secretary of the Interior at Washington, who had formerly resided near him in Boston and with whom he had a long acquaintance. There had been a change of administration the fall previous, and he was certain that the new administration would not ignore the situation. To the secretary, and also to a number of his friends, he wrote personal letters, explaining in detail the exact condition of affairs in Union County. He had not seen Dunleavy since the day the latter had come to the Kicker office to negotiate for the purchase of the paper. On several of his rides to and from the Circle Bar ranch, he had seen signs of life at the Circle Cross. Once or twice, he thought he saw someone watching him from a hill on the Circle Cross side of the Rabbit Ear. But of this he was not quite certain, for the hilltop was thickly wooded and the distance great. He had been warned by Norton not to ride too often over the same trail, lest Dunleavy send someone to ambush him. Hollis had laughed at the warning, though thanking Norton for it. He told his range boss that he did not anticipate any immediate trouble with Dunleavy. "It all depends upon how Big Bill feels," returned Norton with a grim smile. "If you got him mad, there's no telling. And there are plenty of places between here and Dry Bottom where a man might be shot from ambush, and nobody would ever know who done it. I wouldn't ride the Dry Bottom trail every day. There's the old Coyote Trail that takes you past the Razorback and through Devil's Hollow to Little Canyon and along the hills to the other side." He laughed. "There's only one thing you need to be afraid of if you take the Coyote Trail, and that's Ed Hazelton. Ed gets spells when he's plumb crazy. He's Nellie Hazelton's brother, her that Dunleavy was pestering when you slammed him." He laughed again, significantly. "Though if Ed knowed you was the man who took his sister's part, you wouldn't need to be much scared of him. I've heard that he's got a pretty good memory for his friends, even when he's off." Hollis had not told Norton of his experience in Devil's Hollow, nor did he tell him now, but he followed his advice about taking the Coyote Trail, and the following day, when he made the trip to Dry Bottom, he returned that way. About halfway between Dry Bottom and the Circle Bar, he came upon a little adobe cabin, snuggling an arroyo through which trickled a small stream of water. It was an ideal location for a small rancher, and Hollis observed that the buildings were in order. Evidently Nellie Hazelton and her brother were provident. He saw some cattle grazing on the edge of a small grass plateau, which began at the slope of the arroyo and through which the stream of water ran. A shout reached his ears as he sat motionless in the saddle, looking about him, and he saw Ed Hazelton on the plateau among the cattle, waving a hand to him. The young man began to descend the side of the plateau, but before he had fairly started, Nellie Hazelton had come out of the front door of the cabin and stood on the edge of the small porch, smiling at him. "So you did come after all," was her greeting. Hollis spurred his pony closer and sat smiling down at her. "I don't think anything could have stopped me after your invitation," he returned quickly. "Oh," she said. The sudden color that came into her face told of her confusion. It betrayed the fact that she knew he had come because of her. Her brother's invitation in Devil's Hollow had been merely formal. There had been another sort of invitation in her eyes as she and her brother had left him that day. "Won't you get off your horse," she said, while he still sat motionless. "It's quite a while before sundown, and you have plenty of time to reach the Circle Bar before dark." He had determined to discover something of the mystery that surrounded her and her brother, so he was off his pony quickly and seating himself in a chair that she drew out of the cabin for him. By the time her brother had reached the porch, Hollis was stretched comfortably out in the chair and was answering several timid questions concerning his opinion of the country and his new responsibilities. She was glad he liked the country, she said. It was wonderful. In the 5 years they had been here, they had enjoyed it thoroughly. That was, of course, barring the trouble they had had with Dunleavy. Of their trouble with Dunleavy, Hollis would hear much later, he told himself. At present, he was more interested in discovering something about her and her brother. though he did not wish to appear inquisitive. Therefore his voice was politely casual.
"Then you are not a Westerner," he said.
She smiled mournfully. "No," she returned. "We, Ed and I, were raised in Illinois, near Springfield. We came out here 5 years ago, after Mother died." Her voice caught. "Sometimes it seems terribly lonesome out here," she added, "when I get to thinking of our other home." But she smiled bravely through the sudden moisture that had come into her eyes. "Since Ed got hurt, I don't have much time to think of myself. Poor fellow." Hollis was silent. He had never had a sister, but he could imagine how she must feel over the misfortune that had come to her brother. It must be a sacrifice for her to remain in this country, to care for a brother who must be a great burden to her at times, to fight the solitude, the hardships, to bear with patience the many inconveniences which are inevitable in a new, unsettled country. He felt a new admiration for her and a profound sympathy. "I think that you must be a very brave young woman," he said earnestly. "Oh," she returned with a sudden, illuminating smile, "it isn't hard to be brave, but at times I find it hard to be patient." "Patience is one of the cardinal virtues," declared Hollis, "but it takes bravery of a rare sort to remain in this country surrounded with the care." Her fingers were suddenly over her lips warningly, and he saw Ed Hazelton nearing the porch. "I wouldn't have him know for the world," she said rapidly. "It isn't a care to look after someone you love." Hollis smiled grimly at the reproach in her voice and rose to greet her brother. The latter seemed to be quite recovered from the attack he had suffered in Devil's Hollow, and talked freely and intelligently of affairs in the country. Hollis found that on the whole he was a well-informed young man, quiet, modest, and apparently well able to give a good account of himself in spite of his affliction. He was bitter against Dunleavy and thanked Hollis warmly for his defense of his sister. At sundown Hollis departed, telling the Hazeltons that since he was their neighbor he would not neglect to see them occasionally. As he rode away into the dusk, Nellie Hazelton stood on the porch, smilingly waving her hand at him. As he threaded his way through the rapidly growing darkness, he felt an unaccountable satisfaction over the fact that he had elected to remain in Union County, that henceforth his fortunes were to be linked with those of a brave young woman who had also accepted the robes of sacrifice and who was committed to war against their common enemy, Dunleavy. Curiously, during the past few days, he had felt a decided change in his attitude toward life. His old ambition was no longer uppermost in his mind. It had been crowded out of his existence. In its place had been erected a new pinnacle of promise. A seat among the mighty was a worthy goal. Yet the lowly bench of sacrifice was not without its compensations. End of chapter 7.
Chapter 8 of The Coming of the Law by Charles Alden Seltzer. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Concerning the 6 o'clock. On Friday evening previous to the Saturday, on which the kicker was to be issued for the 5th consecutive time by Hollis, Potter did not ride out to the Circle Bar. There still remained some type to be set, and Potter had declared his intention of completing the work and staying overnight in town. Hollis had acquiesced and had departed for the Circle Bar alone. When he reached Dry Bottom the following morning, he found a small crowd of people in front of the kicker's office. During the night, someone had posted a written notice on the front door, and when Hollis dismounted from his pony, there were perhaps a dozen interested citizens grouped about the door, reading the notice. There were several of the town's merchants and a number of cowboys, new arrivals, and those who had remained overnight to gamble and participate in the festivities that were all-night features of the dives. There were also the usual loafers, who constitute an element never absent in any group of idlers in any street. All, however, gave way before Hollis and allowed him to reach the door without molestation, though in passing he observed significant grins on several faces. The notice was written in a bold, legible hand. "Mr. Hollis," it read, the prefix underscored. "The express leaves town this afternoon at 6 o'clock, going east. Better be on it. Signed, YZ. Hollis read the notice and then turned and quietly surveyed his watchful, interested audience. He smiled grimly, seeing several faces which, though plainly expressing amusement, seemed quietly sympathetic. He felt that these were wishing him success, though doubting his ability to cope with his enemies. Other faces were plainly antagonistic in expression. He looked at both for an instant and then turned again to the notice and, producing a pencil, printed boldly on its face the slogan he had devised. "We herald the coming of the law. The kicker is here to stay." And below, he indulged in his sarcasm. "Don't hold the express on my account. Signed, Kent Hollis." Leaving his audience to stare after him, Hollis pushed open the door of the office and entered. He found Potter bending over the imposing table, hard at work on one of the forms. Three other forms, locked and ready for the press, stood in a corner. Potter looked up and smiled as his chief entered. "See the notice on the door?" he inquired. "Some of Dunleavy's work, I suppose," returned Hollis. "Well, yes, I suppose Dunleavy is back of it, but Yuma tacked the sign up." He smiled soberly as Hollis flashed a grin at him. "They tried hard last night to get me to drink. Of course, their purpose was to get me drunk so that I wouldn't be able to get the paper out today. I'm not going to tell you how hard I had to fight myself to resist the temptation to drink, but you can see for yourself that I succeeded. The kicker will be ready to go to press in an hour." He felt Hollis's hand patting his shoulder approvingly, and he continued a little hoarsely. "I took one drink at the Fashion last night after I got through here. Then I came back and went to sleep. I am a light sleeper, and when some time after midnight I heard a sound at the door, I got up and peered out of the window. I saw Yuma tacking up the notice. I suppose Dunleavy wrote it." He looked at Hollis with a whimsical expression. "I suppose you are going to take the express?" he inquired. "Tried to get you drunk, did they?" shaking his head negatively to Potter's question, a smile on his face. "I can't understand that game," he continued soberly. "Of course, getting you drunk would have prevented the appearance of the paper on scheduled time. But if they wanted to do serious damage, of course I mean to the paper," he apologized with a grim smile, "why didn't they come down here, some of them, during your absence, and smash things up? That would have made the thing sure for them." Potter laughed mirthlessly. "Of course they could have done that," he said. "It would have been easy, will be easy any time. But it wouldn't be artistic, would be coarse, in fact. Dunleavy doesn't do things that way. If they smash your stuff, destroy your plant here, ruin your type and press and so forth, they invite sympathy in your behalf. But if they prevent the appearance of your paper without having done any damage to your plant, they accomplish something. They expose you to ridicule. And in this country, ridicule is a potent weapon, even if it involves nothing more serious than a drunken printer." Hollis shook Potter's hand in silence. He had expected violence from Dunleavy. Long before this, he had expected him to show his hand, to attempt some covert and damaging action. And he had been prepared to fight to get the kicker out. He had not expected subtlety from Dunleavy. He went to his desk and sat in the chair, looking out through the window at the crowd that still lingered in front of the office. Most of the faces wore grins. Plainly, they were amused. But Hollis saw that the amusement was of a grim sort. They appreciated the situation and enjoyed its humor.
but felt the tragedy behind it. Probably most of them were acquainted with Dunleavy's methods. Some of them probably knew of the attempt that had been made to incapacitate Potter. Certainly those of them that did know had seen the failure of the attempt and were now speculating upon Dunleavy's next move. Looking out of the window, Hollis felt that some of his audience must be wondering whether the editor of the Kicker would pay any attention to the notice on the door. Would he scare? Hollis had already decided that he would not scare. He grinned at several of the men who watched him and then turned and instructed Potter to take down a column of type on the first page of the paper to make room for an article that he intended to write. Then he seized a pen and wrote a red-hot defiance directed at the authors of the notice, which Potter set up under the heading, "Why the Editor of the Kicker Won't Take the Express." In clear, terse language, he told his audience his reasons. This was America. He was an American, and he didn't propose to allow the Cattlemen's Association or any other association, gang, or individual to dictate the policy of his paper or influence his private actions. Least of all did he propose to allow anyone to run him out of town. He printed the notice entire, adding his answer, assuring readers that he was sending copies of the Kicker to every newspaper in the East, and that notices such as had been affixed to his door would react against the authors. He ended with a prophecy that law would come into Union County, and that meanwhile the Kicker proposed to fight. At noon, Hollis took the usual number of copies to the station and mailed them. Walking down the street on his return from the station, he attracted much attention. Men stood in the open doorways of saloons watching him. A number openly jeered. Others sent subtle jibes after him. Still others were silent, their faces expressing amusement. But he looked at none of them. He swung along the boardwalk, his face a little pale, his lips tightly closed, determined to pay no attention to the jeers that reached his ears. When he passed the fashion, there were a number of men draped along its front, and he was conscious of many grins. Passing the men, he heard low laughter and profane reference, which caused his cheeks to redden. But he walked steadily on. Near the Kicker office, he met Jiggs Lanahan. Followed by the youth, he reached the office to find that Potter had completed the press work and that several hundred copies of the paper, the ink still moist on its pages, were stacked in orderly array on the imposing stone. In a very brief time, Jiggs burst out of the office door, a bundle of papers under his arm, and began the work of distribution. Standing back from the window with Potter, Hollis watched Jiggs until the latter reached the crowd in front of the fashion saloon. Then all that Hollis could see of him was his red head, but that trade was brisk was proved by the press around Jiggs. The youth was passing out papers at a rapid rate, and soon nearly every man in the crowd about the fashion was engaged in reading, or, if this important feature of his education had been neglected, in questioning his neighbor concerning the things that appeared in the paper. Presently, Jiggs' customers in front of the fashion were all supplied. Then other purchasers appeared. Soon the Kicker was being read by, it seemed, nearly every grown person in Dry Bottom. Business was suspended. Down the street, men were congregated about the doors of many of the stores. Others were sitting in doorways. Still others leaned against buildings. Some, not taking the time to search for support, read while walking, or stood motionless on the board sidewalks, satisfying their curiosity. Hollis watched through the window until he began to be certain that every person in town was supplied with a paper. Then, with a grim smile, he left the window and sought his chair beside the desk. He was satisfied. Dunleavy had made the first aggressive movement, and the fight was on. End of chapter 8.
Life's better with American Family Insurance. Because we know in making the most of your home, DIY doesn't just stand for do-it-yourself. It also means dream it yourself. And we're here to help protect the dreams you're building. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.